I can't really hear what Jeremy says because I got my two Stanley Cup rings plugged in my ear.
It's a special edition of the Can't Hear What Jeremy Says podcast with host Adrian Dater. In this special edition, AD welcomes in New York Times bestselling author Jeff Perlman to the show to discuss his newest book, Three Ring Circus, Kobe, Shaq, Phil, and the Crazy Years of the Lakers Dynasty. As a disclaimer, there were some recording issues, so the audio file used is a backup, and for that we apologize for any parts that may be hard to hear. But without further ado, let's get into it.
Okay, Jeff Perlman. Hey, Jeff, thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it. I know you're not a regular on a hockey podcast too often, but I'm a writer, you're a writer. We've both written books, and I thought it'd be great to have you on to promote your latest book and also talk about the craft a little bit more and get into a little bit of the life of Jeff Perlman, too. So thanks for being here, man. I appreciate it.
I'm still for someone to talk to me about the Islanders.
Jeff, that is one of my first questions, I guess, is, you know, you're such a well-rounded sports guy. You've written books on three different sports, but I've heard you say it, and I think on a podcast and on your great two writer Sling and Yang podcast, I've read your stuff on the Quaz. And on Twitter, where you're very prolific, you never were a hockey guy. Why didn't you ever get into hockey?
Right, so I do love hockey as a live sport. Like, I enjoy going to hockey games immensely. I think when I was a kid growing up, I was raised by non-sports fans.
Okay.
And when you're raised by non-sports fans and you're discovering sports on your own, you know, the sports you're going to cover are the ones you see the most, the ones you saw the most, especially as a kid. Baseball, football, and a little basketball, and hockey was never there. And it wasn't like my parents would ever say, oh, why don't we go to an Islanders game? Why don't we go to a Rangers game? It wasn't even a thought of a thought. So it was never a part of my life. And as you got, like, it's Sports Illustrated, I don't think I ever covered hockey.
Yeah.
Maybe one. I think I did some previews. I think I did NHL previews one year where I interviewed people for previews, but that's it. And I love going to the games. I've probably gone in my life to 10 hockey games. I've never not had a good time. But I have one hockey tie.
Yeah.
I have one hockey tie, and it's a really weird one. Can I tell you my weird hockey story?
Absolutely.
Okay. When I was a kid growing up in a tiny town called Mailpack, New York,
yep.
There used to be my local radio station had a morning, Saturday morning sports talk show, and it was called Talking Sports. It was a very creatively named show.
Yeah.
And it was hosted by two guys. One guy was named Tip Ballsbury. The other guy was Joe Bucchino, who was the assistant general manager of the New York Rangers.
Wow.
And
yeah.
To Phil Esposito.
Yeah.
And I used to call in every week, and Joe Bucchino, the assistant GM for the Rangers, would always go, well, I'd be like, it's Jeff from Mailback. And I was like 13 years old. And he'd say, my man, my man, my man, every time. Well, when I was writing for my high school newspaper, I wanted to do a profile of Joe Bucchino. And I interviewed Joe Bucchino for my high school newspaper, and I asked him why there weren't more blacks playing hockey.
Yep. Wow.
His reply was because they don't have the leg strength to play hockey.
Oh, geez.
And that ran in the Mailpack High School student newspaper the season. And I was thinking how lucky Joe Bucchino was that I was not a New York Times.
Oh, you know, God,
New York,
yeah.
News reporter.
Oh, man.
His career would have ended far earlier.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, really? Yeah. No, that's Al Campanis territory right there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Huh. As a high school kid, I buried it. I buried it, like,
wow.
Paragraphs in because I didn't realize it was anything. I was 17-year-old Jeff Perlman at the Mailpack High School.
Oh, geez. Wow, that's... That would have made you a national name itself for your byline at that time. On the one sense, I'm... You know, sad that didn't run in a sense, and then in a sense, I'm good for Mr. Patino there that there wasn't Twitter and instant online world then. Mahopic, New York. I've actually been through there. I'm from the East too, and I've driven all over the East. You know, I'm from New Hampshire, but I grew up with relatives in New York and New Jersey and things like that. And, you know, not going to belabor this hockey thing, but yeah, I would have thought that's pretty good hockey territory. Islander fans, Ranger fans, Connecticut, you know, the Rangers Connecticut base is huge. So yeah, I'm a little surprised. Yeah, I'm a little surprised you never got into hockey that much. I mean, it was a pretty big deal in the 80s, too, when you were probably in your teen years when the Islanders were winning Stanley Cups. I guess I'm a little surprised it never really rubbed off on you.
I know, it's weird. And I actually identified as an Islanders fan. Yeah. I grew up in a town where they were mostly Ranger fans, and I was contrarian. So, Mike Bossy, obviously, and Trotsky, and Smith, and all kinds of them. So it's not that I didn't like hockey. I just didn't pay enough attention to it to become a major fan.
Right. And I'm probably the same way, you know, in a sense. Grew up a basketball and baseball junkie. It was sort of by accident that I was thrown into hockey as a sports writer. But, I know you, you're a New York guy. I'm pure Celtic green. Larry Bird is my avatar on Twitter. Basketball, I'm 6'6". So I could really actually play the game of basketball when I was a teenager, and that was always my favorite game. And you know, we made the state semifinals as a high school kid, and I was a starting center and glory days and Bruce Springsteen and cue it up right now, right? I got into hockey just because of by the only guy who covered hockey at the Denver Post at the time, and then we got an NHL team, but that's a whole other podcast. Jeff, your ninth book is out. It's in the top 100 of Amazon book sales. I've written 7 books myself, okay? They've mostly been regional books, okay? So I haven't written the national narrative, national scope books that you have. And that's something I need to probably cry about later on, because I'm going to be, that's something that I haven't done yet and want to do. But I've written regional books. And they've all sold okay. One of them has made me royalty money, but I do remember always checking Google or Amazon ranking on as a, legit like addiction thing. Are you that way still after 9 books when you look at the, rankings? Be honest.
Yeah, sure. Well, my wife says it for me more than I do. Like, she'll be like, you're down 3, you're up 2.
You can't do that. That's tough.
Yesterday at like 44.
Yep.
My highest ever, I'm spoiled. I wrote a book about the Dallas Cowboys, and I think I was number 6.
Yeah.
And that was, I was like, oh my God, I'm number 6.
Yeah. That's good, though.
The two measures that I really have are how high are you on Amazon, and do you make the New York Times list? So those are the two things I look to. And I mean, you see it. Like, one thing, I'm not saying I'm the greatest writer of this, but I do put my all into marketing and pimping a book.
Yeah, I would say so. We're going to get into that.
I feel like you can't spend all that time working on a book and then just say, all right, I hope it sells well. Like,
yeah,
I want to continue to do this. I want to continue to get paid reasonably well to do it. And that means, this is my, for this book, this is my, I think, 106th interview.
Yeah.
So I just count like those books. I mean, it's exhausting and tiring and whatever, but you have to do it and you should do it.
Yeah, man. And I've done it too, on a lesser scale, but I've done all the interviews on radio. I've done a million radio interviews in my life. I've written 7 books, right? So I've done book signings and store. Yeah. They probably haven't sold on the Jeff Perlman level, and that's okay. But I am a very competitive guy. I still might want to catch you someday. I threw my heart and soul into all those books and worked as hard as I could to promote them and stuff. And I saw your video today on Twitter. You have to be your best PR guy now, because PR people at books now, first of all, the book selling business is much more, stratified in a sense than it used to be. There are employees that do quote unquote promotion for book publishing houses now, but they're not at the level that it used to be in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and you, Jeff Perlman, have been somebody who just works tirelessly on the promotion of what you do. And I think it's catching, I think it's caught on, you're in the top 100 in book sales for a Laker book. That is great. And I've read most of it. Okay. I've read most of it. I got my hands on it last night. And so I have more questions about that, but man, like you said, I've been there, and I know that you're tired doing these interviews, but probably a month from now, you're going to say, you know what? I kind of risk my phone ringing all day long and doing interviews, right? It's a deal with the devil you do. It's a Faustian bargain in a sense. You're tired when you do it, but you're going to miss it when it's gone in a sense in a month, right?
Yeah, well, it's funny because I saw today, I think I had about 22 minutes. And then I saw tomorrow, I only have like 15.
Yep.
And you would think I'd be thrilled because I woke up at 5:30 this morning.
Right. I saw your video.
Conversation at 5:40. Oh my God, I'm so exhausted and so tiring.
Your eyes were shut.
Thrilling. But I think I'll be, a part of me will be like, oh man, only 15. You know, like, it's funny. It is funny. You complain and then you miss it.
Yeah, you know? I know. I've had one book that sold into the, I would say, low to mid five figures, okay? And it still makes me royalty money and stuff like that. You know, and yeah, I mean, I guess I'll take that, right? The other six books were kind of regional. Like, you get your advance money, and a couple didn't sell as well as they should have, and I still probably kick myself over that. One of the books I did was a book with Craig Morton, the ex Giants QB, who you probably remember from the 70s as a little kid. But
I know him because he played in the USFL.
Okay, right. He was a coach. Right, he was a coach at Denver Gold. Of course. Okay. So you've talked to Craig.
I did talk to Craig.
Did I actually give you the number for Craig? I can't even remember. I've given the number to Craig for before. I don't think I did to you.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so either. Okay. Yeah. Well, the book with Craig Morton didn't sell as well because I don't think that I worked hard enough to promote it. And that's something that, you know, I had to learn from. You know, I should have been out there flogging it all day long. But I guess what happened was, you know, it was a book about the Broncos in the 70s that just maybe 30 years later, it just wasn't quite relevant enough, you know, for people's memories. That brings me into a question about the book you just did, right? It's you have, you know, you did a great book, man. It's a good book. It's 448 pages, and it's really deeply reported. That's what you're known for. Jeff, one question I have is, you kind of shame a lot of people like me. I think I work hard, right? I run my own site. I work for another gambling site. You know, that's here, neither here nor there, but it's made me money, and I enjoy doing it, actually. It's kind of fun. You know, and I do other things, but I feel like I don't work nearly as hard as you. You do so much work. You do your podcast, Two Writers Slinging Yang. You write books all day long, all year long. You've done, you know, other things, the quads. You're constantly online. You're constantly doing this and that. Where did you get your work ethic, man?
I don't think I try to work harder than you. I am. I don't
think, I think you do.
My job. No, but I'm saying my job is writing books. So, you know, my job is running for the time. Like, man, that's enough time. Well, I'm not doing another job. This is it for me.
Yeah.
100%. And I'm not covering hockey. I'm not covering anything. I'm writing books.
Right. So
that's a big part of it. The other thing is I just really enjoy it. Like, I really enjoy it. I really enjoy the dig. The dig is my favorite part. And tracking down. I love tracking down people. And I love finding people. So it's, you know, I used to have a lot more hobbies than I have now. I don't really have any hobbies. Like, my hobby is writing people. Like,
yeah,
and digging. And I'll say something else. As you were speaking, I just went to your Amazon page.
Yeah.
And, like, number one, these are excellent books you wrote. Like, you should be proud of this. You shouldn't be, oh, you know, I haven't sold them. Like,
I appreciate it.
The other thing is, like, a big thing that I do, I'm just being honest, is, like, pick national subjects every single time. Like, hockey is a tough sell anyway.
Yep.
I mean, it is. Hockey is a tougher sell.
Yep.
Like, you pick Patrick Waugh and the return of the Colorado Avalanche, and I'm writing about Shaq Kobe and the Lakers. That's not a
fucking
question. You're doing, like, another thing is, like, Craig Morton. I love Craig Morton, but nostalgia moves with the years, and, like, 70s isn't nostalgia anymore. 80s is barely nostalgia anymore. You know, like, early 90s feels more like nostalgia, because as people get older, book buyers get older, and you're people who are watching the 78 Yankees are now even 5 years old, and they're probably not buying a book.
So, yeah.
It's just like, I always think about the market,
right?
Who's going to be buying it, who it appeals to, is there an audience? Like, I think about that crap all the time, because this is the only way I make a living. So I couldn't afford to do, like, Patrick Waugh and the Return of the Avalanche, because it's a niche audience. It doesn't mean it's not worth doing, and it doesn't mean you can't sell 20,000 copies of a really good book, but it's a harder sell
Of course.
That's just a harder sell.
Of course.
Yeah, I know. I know all that too. I know all that too. I grew up a timeshare salesman and as a summer job in college, I sold timeshare on Cape Cod, and I know all about sales numbers and percentages. I guess what it comes down to is I just haven't, maybe I sort of feel like this isn't about me, this podcast, but I feel like maybe I'm 55 years old now. I feel like maybe when I'm 59, 60, if I live that long, of course, and I'm semi-retired, I'm going to make a run, I think, of, 10 straight years of quote national books. I'm going to pick the biggest subject I know. And if I can't sell it, if I can't get the interviews, if I can't get the publisher, then, maybe I'll try to self-publish. Who knows? I don't know. I'm fascinated by your career, though. You started out in Wahapak. You wrote for your Wikipedia page, which, of course, I don't have. Another thing I'm jealous of you about. I don't know who does Wikipedia pages, by the way. Have you ever figured that out, who writes these? There's some person out there. Yeah. All of a sudden, you've looked up one day, and there's a Wikipedia page about you, right?
It's kind of funny.
I'm still waiting for that.
I think when I was at Sports Illustrated, a lot of the writers started just landing. I don't know why, but there was a time when SI was pretty big.
Yeah. I'd say so. I worked there, man.
The writers had to...
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You were, but you worked at Mahopic.
Mailpack.
I'm sorry. You're right. My apologies. Mailpack. It says on your career timeline that you worked for a patent newspaper. Is that? Can you give a little more background on that? Were you writing about patents?
No. There's a weekly newspaper called the Patent Trader. It was just a local paper, and I, after my senior year of high school, after I came home from school, after heading into my freshman year of college, I wrote him a letter to Joe Lombardi, and I asked if I could write. And he let me do local high school sports, and he would pay me in trips to the Melkisto Deli. That's how I got there. I got no money, but he would buy me food, pastrami sandwiches and stuff.
Oh, my God. Wow.
It really sent me on my way. This guy was a really good writer, and willing and able to deal with me, and usually important.
Yeah, man, we all start off small. That's interesting. You, in one sense, you started off really big in your career at a young age, and yet you really didn't. You paid your dues at smaller places. The last question I have before we get into the book is you went from I believe the Tennessean to Sports Illustrated.
Correct.
But you left Sports Illustrated. I know about you got promoted, you got seen, you got noticed, and you got an offer from Sports Illustrated. And that must have been just an unbelievable dream come true. To say you worked at Sports Illustrated in the heyday, I mean, that's something very few people can say. And you did it. You left Sports Illustrated, though, for Newsday. I don't think I've ever heard the story of how that happened. I guess I'm a little surprised. They must have made you a hell of an offer. And maybe you wanted to go back home. Can you talk about that for a second?
Yeah, it's funny. I was my dream from the time I was a kid was to write for Sports Illustrated.
Yeah.
That was my dream. And a lot of it really lived up to the dream. Like, it was great. You said, it was kind of a heyday. I wouldn't say it's not heyday for the magazine. I was there from 96 to 03.
Right.
The heyday was like the 70. Right. Or to 82,
Right. Like, when they had the drink carts going through the office at times. Yeah.
And they were getting wasted in writing. I kind of envy that moment.
Yeah.
I smoked cigarettes and drinking.
Yeah.
But not that I smoked more drinks, but it would have been nice. But I was at SI. I was covering baseball. I was pretty content, but I was getting really burned out.
Yeah.
And I was. And I had a moment, actually, at the 2001 World Cup Series when the Yankees were playing the Diamondbacks. I forgot what game was. I think it was game 3 or game 4. It was at Yankee Stadium. And during the early in the game, I started having stomach cramping. And I wasn't writing that day. I was sitting next to a producer. And I said, I'm going to go home. I don't feel well. And I went to my then-girlfriend, now wife's apartment. And I watched the rest of the game on the couch. And, it ended with, I think it was Scott Rosen hitting an excellent home run.
Yep.
Okay, so it's a huge World Series magical moment. People are going crazy. Yankee Stadium, blah, blah, blah. And I was so happy not to be there. Like, I was happy not to be there. I didn't want to deal with the locker room crush. I didn't want to deal with the head. I didn't want to deal with the cliches of ball players and trying to get quotes and nobody gives a crap. Like,
yeah.
I didn't want to be at one of the greatest games in modern World Series history. And that was an eye-opener to me, where I was like, if I don't want to be at this game, should I be covering baseball? Does that even make sense for me to be covering baseball? And what happened is, I started looking around to see if there's something I could do that wasn't sports. I just needed a break from sports. I needed to get away from sports.
Wow.
And Newsday had this job open, and it was basically roaming around New York City looking for stories for their magazine section, not about sports, not anything. And I would be in front. I would pick stories. I'd pitch them, but they'd almost always say yes. Okay, I want to write 2,000 words about the naked cowboy in Times Square. They'd be like, do it. I want to know how these guys were hip-hop, a hip-hop putting on CDs. I want to do a profile that. Do it. And it was an amazing, refreshing year for me. And what happened is, at the end of the year, about a year, Newsday started to change. It's when newspapers really started to hit the crapper.
Yep.
And they wanted all their writers to come in 4 or 5 days a week. And I lived about an hour and 20 minutes in the office. That's when I decided I was just going to focus on books.
Wow.
So that was it.
Wow. Boy, that was a big, big gutsy decision. I mean,
it was scary.
Yeah,
scary.
I bet. I bet.
Because all I ever wanted to do was write for Sports Illustrated. But I always say, like, I think it's one of the smartest things I ever did in my career because I didn't want to be, you know, I always thought, like, I don't know why I always thought this. I was like, you should leave a job early, not late. Like, you should leave a job when you're still enjoying it.
Yeah.
Not hang on too long.
Yep.
So that was it.
I should have followed my own gut on that too. I stayed too long at the Denver Post. Oh, absolutely. I've been on your podcast and we talked a little bit about my sordid career and what went wrong at the Denver Post and it's surprising to me that I didn't do this, and it's something that I beat myself up for 2 or 3 years before I finally forgave myself. You know, it's like, all right, it happened. I have to just accept it. But I should have quit the Denver Post like 2 or 3, maybe 4 years before I actually left there, you know, in a cloud. Yeah, I know. And I was,
people don't realize this when they're younger. It's not easy to leave health insurance.
Right. I know. And that was part of it. That was part of it. I was making, you know, high five figures at the Post and freelance money. And, you know, I got a son now and I've got a wife and I've got a house. And I thought, shit, I can't really quit just like that when I should. I knew I should. And my unhappiness at the paper kind of morphed into this really bad 2 or 3 years of sort of negative, bad personal behavior that kind of foisted itself on the public. I wish it didn't, but it did. And now I'm kind of glad it did. You know, I was forced to change. I'm actually much happier now than I was. I wish I didn't have a cloud of shit on Twitter that I had to go through, but that's just my cross to bear, and that's the way it was, and that's okay, you know. So you're talking to a happy guy now. If you talked to me 5 years ago, I would have, you know, I know my podcast with you is kind of a therapy session in a way. But it's different now, you know. I've learned so much. I mean, I was a substitute teacher for a couple of years after that, and I got to teach, you know, poor kids in a really tough school. You know, I wouldn't trade that experience for anything now. You know,
of course.
Yeah. So you know, that's, you know, stuff happens. Now I'm back writing, and it's all good. Jeff, the book itself is great. It's a great read. I really liked it. I'm not a Laker fan. I grew up a Celtic fan in Boston, but I do, you know, I was always fascinated by the Lakers and everything, how they work. You were able to really get inside the Lakers, it seemed like, from your relationship somehow with Jeannie Buss. Can you talk more about how that really happened? Otherwise, it seemed like, and I know there was an ex-PR guy too. I think his name was Jack Black. No.
John Black.
I'm thinking the movie star, of course. John Black. those two people really sort of paved the way for you to get inside Lakerland, which is normally a very tough place to get into. I'm interested in how that was formulated for you, and how that started. Was it because maybe you moved to Southern California several years ago?
No. I wrote a book.
Which I read and I loved.
Thank you.
Yes.
So that was about the Union Speakers. And when I was working on that book, she was in a very unique owner. She didn't know me from anyone. And I reached out to them when I was working on that book. And I said, is there anywhere I can interview you? And she said, okay. And this is the owner of the Crystal Lakers. And she just shows up at lunch. She's like, why do I meet at this place? So it's her and Linda Rampus, her Rampus.
Wow.
And they just show up for lunch. And
God.
For like 2 hours talking, and they're both great.
Jeez.
And in the years since, Amy has spoken to my college classes a couple of times. She's a nice person. She really is just a nice person. And so this time, you know, I called her and I said, I'm working on the book. And she said, great, that's cool. And she connected me with Phil Jackson. She gave me time with herself. And so it worked out well. So I don't know. Try to be a nice person, I guess.
Yeah, you know, I know you
I
got.
Go easy on them.
No, that's.
Kiss up book.
That's how you got into the first book. Yeah, that's. I probably should have rephrased it for your first book, but that's how you got into the relationships with the Lakers, you know, going back to your first book. Not an easy nut to crack. It's a great. I love Showtime. I love some of the anecdotes you had. I think I tweeted you about one of them. You know, it was about Billy Thompson, and you know, there was a couple things about no Billy, you know, and that's the kind of stuff that I actually like a lot, sort of the really inside stuff, you know. One of the questions I wanted to ask you, going back to sort of something that I think you and I have in common a little bit, is maybe our love for that kind of stuff, that insider stuff, you know, was fermented maybe at a really young age by the books we used to read. One of them was those Xander Hollander books about the NBA. And you know, and they had that inside dope from the beat writers, you know, that they couldn't always get away with in their regular newspapers. Is that something you just like me, you have all your Xander Hollander books still and you treasure those, and that's where some of that maybe came from, your love for digging and getting that inside dope?
Yeah, I think so. I still have most of those books. I still look at them. There's usually one or two in a bathroom on a toilet somewhere. Also, when I was a kid growing up, I was like a big Peter Bolenbach fan and a big fan of sports biographies.
Right.
I would always be reading the Mailpack Library. Would actually, a librarian there would hold them for me when I was a kid, and she would call and say, hey, Jeff, just so you know, we just got Bo Jackson's new book, and you should come down here. And I would run down, get the book, you know, run down with my library card, get the book, run home, absorb it. So I was a huge, huge sports book reader as a kid. Enormous. Mm-hmm. Definitely had an impact, no doubt about it.
Yeah, me too, those books. Your books are, you know, this is, let's face it, we're in 2020 now. Your book is selling. It's doing well. I feel like you found a niche in a sense that, you know, you're telling the stories after they've already been told by the first draft writers in the world, which probably includes people like me and newspaper, you know, online writers who are still covering teams and such. Do you feel like that is the true future? The only future we have left for sports media is in a sense, you know, sports writing's last salvation, in a sense, is the going back and telling the deeper stories that we can't always get to in the newspaper world. And you grew up in that world, so you know what I'm talking about. And is that one conscious decision you made when you went into the book writing business?
My first book, an agent approached me, and she said, I'm wondering if you ever thought about writing books. I said, not really. And she said, what do you think about a book about the 86 Nets?
Yeah.
And I said, that's a really good idea. I mean, I grew up in New York. I was 14 when that happened, 13, 14. I loved the team, and I wrote it. And I am I don't watch many sports now. Like, I'm not
people were asking other podcasts about the NBA playoffs.
I know.
A bit of a guess for me.
I know. I heard your thing. You said you didn't even know the Padres had made the playoffs yesterday. I was a little surprised and saddened by that.
Well, don't be sad by it, because I just don't pay that much attention.
Yeah. But I'm the same way. I'm the same way, and yet I feel like you were still on that roll, you know.
No. I haven't been in years. I enjoy going to games to relax. I enjoy going to games with my son. We watch baseball games when there's no COVID, obviously, and it's great. But I haven't paid attention to the standings in forever, and I didn't even know the season was ending, and I didn't know any of that. I am a whole power for me of the books, so the whole draw is nostalgia. I mean, I think sports and music are the two areas where nostalgia is carried today.
Yeah.
Because it's like hearing a really good song and thinking about a game. Like, think about the game where the ball went beneath Buckner's legs, game 6 of the 86 World Series. There's something about the power of that takes you back in time and makes you remember what it felt like, where you were sitting, who you were sitting with, what you were eating, what you were doing, who your girlfriend was at the time. The same with music, and sometimes with food. Like, you smell a ziti, and you're taken back in time to your grandma's kitchen in whatever, Garden City. And I'm a sucker for that stuff. I'm an absolute sucker for that stuff. I love looking back.
Me too. I've often been accused of that. I'm a very sentimental guy. I'm afraid to say, though, Jeff, that's the one book of yours I can't read. Can I tell you my real quick Boston story from that night? Okay. 1986. I'm in Cape Cod. It's a summer job selling timesharing. And I'm actually in a hotel room. We sold timesharing. I was with a girlfriend that I had for all throughout college. Shout out to Sheila. We're still friends. And she had gone to sleep, right? And I'm in the hotel room just sitting at the edge of my seat thinking the Red Sox are going to win the World Series. This is unbelievable. I've been a fan since I was at birth. When the ball went through Buckner's legs, of course, I actually went into a literal, honest to God, catatonic shock. And if you know what that is, it's you just sort of freeze for like 30 or 40 minutes. And that's what I did. I couldn't move. That's how big a fan I was of the Red Sox and how much that affected me. And so, yeah, I actually met Bill Buckner later on in my sports writing career. And I said, hey, man, no hard feelings. And
he was worried about how you were feeling about it.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. I was like, this is like 4 years later, 5 years later when he's retired. Yeah, I know. It's stupid. I know. I'm finally glad I set him straight in a life of, you know, ease after that. My condolences. I know. But yeah, that's the one sports subject that I still really don't like to see. I immediately switch the channels when it happens, and I can't really read about it. So maybe another 10 years, Jeff, I'll pick it up, and I'm sure it's great. I'm sure I learned a lot about the Mets. The book, I thought your best reporting in the book was the hardest reporting, and that was the Kobe thing in Colorado. And it's two full chapters, and I thought it was tough reporting, but it was something that I learned much more about that didn't know so much at the time. And I lived in Denver and I worked at the Denver Post at the time. We covered that trial pretty hard. I didn't cover it, but you know, we had reporters out there all the time. That part of the book probably had to have been the hardest to write. And that was before Kobe's death. After Kobe's death, it had to be a really scary moment for you. I know you've talked about this in your various podcasts that I've heard, but is there still a part of you that's waiting for the other shoe to drop? Like, what if Vanessa Bryant comes out and says, gosh, you know, this guy's bringing up old dirty laundry at a time when I'm still grieving. You've been through the ringer with the Peyton book where you had to write some stuff, tough stuff. You've been through it with the John Rocker story. Are you better girded to deal with that, or are you still sort of dreading that might happen, and are you game planning for that still?
I would say both.
Yeah.
I'd say I'm definitely more steel than I used to be. I'm more, you know, prepared for it. Totally unprepared with Walter Payton.
Yeah.
I'm totally unprepared with John Rocker. Yeah, I'm 48 years old now. You learn to go along.
Yeah.
I feel like, in a way, I've been playing a little
Yep.
I have, you know, five defensive backs in the game as we speak. You know, I just,
yeah.
You know, I wrote a prologue, basically a new prologue
yep.
about it.
Yep.
Every interview I do, I make clear, and I really mean it, so I'm not lying, that this is a period of his life and it's not the entirety. I keep waiting for the other shoe to drop. I keep waiting for someone to say, you know, for 1,000 people on Twitter to call me this guy who's taking advantage of Kobe's death and et cetera, et cetera. Because Twitter is mean, you know, and social media is mean. People are mean, and they're always looking for bad intentions, even if you didn't have them. So, it's definitely a little bit of walk down eggshells about this all.
Yeah, but I don't, you know, from one guy to another, I don't think you're going to deal with that too much because I think, you know, I think that prologue was great that you wrote, and that was a smart move to do that. But I think it was honest too. Like you wished Kobe was around, of course, because I'm sure you wanted Kobe to talk all about that, but he didn't do it. I know he was doing his Mamba book and the Showtime series, and he wanted his own voice out there at the time you're writing the book. So, you know, unfortunately you didn't get him, but I don't know. I feel like you did the honest work on that. And Kobe admitted that it happened and that something, you know, he was a mistake and that's that. You know, I don't think anybody's going to say, oh, ha, you know, Jeff, you bastard, you know, you shouldn't have, you know, that's part of his history. And even he said that. So with that, we'll move on to a happy time. I also thought the probably my other favorite chapters were the two books with two chapters where you actually went to visit your subjects. That was Phil Jackson. That was Shaquille O'Neal. Shaquille in Atlanta, Phil Jackson in Montana. I've heard the story now about five times how Phil said, I'm only doing this for Genie Bus. And then he drove you around a lake for 3 hours. I'm interested in the really, really nitty gritty details though. When Phil said he wanted to take a nap and he'd meet you for dinner later, what did you do at that moment? Did you go back to a hotel that you had in Montana? And what was your game?
I took a walk around town for a while. Really? Back to the hotel.
No kidding.
Yeah.
And then when you met him, was Phil in a more philosophic mood after he had the nap, or was it before the nap when he was driving you around the lake? I'm more interested in what was Phil's mood like in both those situations?
Around the lake, I would say he was more tour guide than anything else. A lot of him being the tour guide and me being a first timer Montana. And then at dinner, I thought relatively philosophical. I mean, it wasn't like I was going to dinner with Sprite, but he was, you know, what I like about him is he asked a lot of questions. You know, it's enjoyable when you
talk to
someone. You know, someone you're writing about and you ask, so what did your wife do or how about your kids? And you can have a back and forth exchange. And I just thought over dinner, it's really cool. He's a really generous and nice host. I mean, I paid for dinner. I don't mean to host financially, but like, I was on his turf. He could have been a jerk. He could have given me 10 minutes. He could have done whatever he wanted.
Yep.
I also think, to be honest, I think he was happy to have the company. Happy to have someone to talk to.
Really?
You know?
Huh.
He's not married. I mean, he doesn't have a girlfriend, I don't think, at that point. He's just happy to talk to someone.
Yeah. Cool. Interesting, isn't it? A guy who probably, you know, has a million contacts in the world, but sometimes they're the loneliest people. Yep. It's a Citizen Kane effect almost, right? Jeff, kept you long enough, but I do want to get a couple sort of quick hitter questions in here, okay?
Okay.
I love the book, and I'm going to be doing, you know, a lot more promo of it sort of after the fact, you know, like I want to, you know, link to it and shit like that. But, you know, have you ever been, I'm curious about this as a writer, and this has not happened to me, but I'm curious if it happened to you because you've written some big subjects for big books. Has anybody ever asked you for payment to be interviewed? And subpart to that is, would you ever consider doing it if it was big enough?
So I had early on, when I did that first book about the 86 Mets.
Yep.
Lenny Dykstra.
Oh, no, big surprise.
I know. He's like... I talked to him, like, I need to fly me to New York. I need to pick you up from so-and-so hotel. And I was like, I literally was 31 years old, 30 years old. Like I had all this money to fly my guys to New York.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So that was a hard sell. And I would not. I wouldn't. I just.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not worth it. It's not worth the someone's going to find out, and then it's going to come out, and other people start asking why they weren't paid, and before my reputation is ruined, I'd rather not get someone and work around.
Right. Can you understand how a player might do that, though? Like, hey, I'm the one who's giving you all this great stuff for a book that you're going to get all the money for, and I'm going to get nothing. I mean, can you understand maybe?
I always say, like, Kobe didn't talk to this book, or Brett Favre didn't talk to this book. Like, they don't owe me a thing.
Right.
Owe me. I have no right to be mad at anyone for not talking to me. They are not doing
– right.
You get no pay. You don't have any editorial say. You can't see the book before it comes out. Why exactly would you talk? The reason you talk is because of legacy and maybe you're bored and maybe you just want to tell your stories.
Right.
Those are the reasons you talk. But if you're looking for money, you're not going to get it and you're not going to have any editorial say. So if you're Kobe Bryant and the last thing you want to do is talk about Eagle, Colorado, why would you talk to me? Like, I get it.
Hey, right. I love the part how you sort of just – went into Eagle and probably no other reporters have done, and you went to the librarian and things like that, and you just asked for stuff, you know, and probably so many other reporters could have had that stuff, but it was you getting on a plane and going to Eagle, Colorado and actually talking to a real librarian that you got all this extra stuff. That's the work ethic, right? That's the stuff where you make the extra legwork, makes the extra call, right? That's where you learned.
Local libraries are just the best.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's probably overlooked now a little bit. But
absolutely.
You want information on a town, a place, on a historical event. Your local library is the best place to go. There's always some librarian who's been there for 30 years.
Yep.
Who really knows the turf and knows the catalog. And that happened there in Eagle. There's a guy who's like, oh, yeah, I think we have all these files. And there was like these huge, thick binders. I mean, it happened with Kobe Bryant. I literally just sat there and made photocopies for 3 hours. It's great.
I think that's the biggest, I mean, for all the young listeners out there who want to know about how to get into the media business, stuff like that, it's that lesson. Go to the people that you can, that, you know, can tell you stuff. Find the extra phone number and make that extra call or go to the scene itself. You know, I'm lucky enough to think I've had that work ethic too in a lot of senses. But Jeff, I have to ask you, you've got like a million friggin' 300-400 sources every book you do. I pride myself on getting phone numbers, you know, and finding them and where people live and stuff. But I don't think I'd hold a candle to you right now, it seems like, where you find these people. Can you give us, without maybe giving your secrets, you don't answer this question, I understand, but is there a place, site, anything where you best site to find phone numbers, things like that? You would reveal it, or do you just not want to answer that?
I mean, there are two. No, I don't mind. There are two of them that are really good. First of all, Nexus Lexus, but that costs a lot of money.
Yeah, it does.
I used to, for years, I've had like passwords that were really mine for Nexus Lexus. I don't anymore. But what I discovered recently, whitepapers.com has this membership, and it's like $20 a month, and you can look up, I think, 500 numbers, and they're cell phone numbers. It's a really good resource. And they're not all right, but a lot of them are.
Hmm.
I've been using that a ton, so I highly recommend that. It's really good.
Huh. You know what? I use White Pages, but I didn't know there was a membership part of it. Maybe that's not why I'm getting as many numbers. Okay. Wow. Interesting.
Nobody answers home phones anymore.
Yeah, I know. Oh, I know. I remember getting Buddy Bell, the Rockies manager, on one of those things. It was cell number. The first question out of his mouth was, I was wrote a book about the Rockies, you know, sold about 18 copies, but his first question was like, how did you get my number? That's when you know, you're onto something. And they usually respect you for that too. Like, how did you get my number? But damn, that you're a good reporter. You found it. So congratulations. They'll usually give you something. I found, to close out this podcast, Jeff, the J.R. Ryder sequence, it's the epilogue of the book. You know, you show up at his house, you knock on the door. You equated that to turbulence in the airplanes on a podcast I listened to. And you said you get a rush out of it, though. First of all, A, do you actually get a rush out of being on turbulence in an airplane and thinking, okay, this is a life or death moment, and it's life or death now? It's kind of exciting in a way, because I've had that same thing. I'm a nervous flyer. And B,
I am too, but
yeah.
I do get a jolt out of that.
Really? So you're an adrenaline junkie in a sense. So when you knocked on J.R. Ryder's door, the adrenaline was kicking in. Whether he hits you or not, it was still fun for you because it was good adrenaline, right? It was something out of your comfort zone.
Yeah, I think I like it. I really like it. Yeah. I do get a jolt out of it. And I get really nervous. Yeah. And as I get closer, you're driving and you're like 5 minutes away, then you're like 3 minutes away, then you're a minute away. Then you're like, wow, I'm really doing this. I'm at this door. I guess I'm going to knock on this door. And I always think it's not going to go well. And I would say, I'm on like a 10 door streak.
Wow.
Except knocking on the door.
Okay, this is my last final question. Jeff, you know, it was so interesting how you got Ryder. And I think that's a lesson for all young journalists out here, which is kind of how I'm hoping to reach in this podcast, is the legwork that you put in, knocking on doors, making every last call. You know, it produces a 448-page book that that I loved is selling well, and I hope it keeps doing that. But Jeff, to summarize and finish up, like, you know, I love your podcast, how you give advice to people. You just say, just keep writing. It's not just writing though, right? It's having the passion to do what you want to do and following through and taking some risk, right? That's the bottom line. That's the bottom line that we all should aspire to do this. And if it doesn't sell a million copies, so what? At least you're proud to look in the mirror and say you worked your ass off on this. Jeff, are you going to take a vacation at some point, though, too? Like, you seem to work really, really hard. You're already working on your next book, which I hear is about Bo Jackson. And a little birdie told me you already interviewed a guy who I knew in New Hampshire way back when, Joe Dudek. For it. I can't wait to hear that story, because I knew him at the time. Are you like content just to keep going from book to book, like, and doing this? Is this it? Is there something else? What if you were offered like a job back at, you know, New York Times? Jeff Perlman, we want you to be our sports columnist. We're going to pay you $500,000 a year. And yeah, you might have to do a lot of travel again, but we're going to do it for you. Jeff, you know, what do you say? You know, are you done with that world, or is it all about books now?
I think I'm done with that world.
Really?
I don't know.
Huh.
I do. I don't love sports enough to be a columnist or to write about modern sports or modern. I just don't love it enough.
Wow, that's so weird for you to say.
I'd be right back where I was at Sports Illustrated in 2000, wondering what the meaning of life is. And you know, like, one of the things I like about this, to be honest, that my life has allowed me to do is be opinionated and political and get involved in political races and offer my takes on things. Like, that means a lot to me. And I do get a lot of writers who DM me, writers I've known for years, and say, I'm really jealous of your independence that you're able to express yourself like that. And I don't want to do it. I just don't want to do it. I don't want to see your side of whatever game and pretend I care. It wouldn't be fair. It's not fair. People who really want to do it, the younger writers coming up who really are passionate about it. It would suck to have some older guy doing it just because, whatever, I have a bigger name or I have a resume. I don't know. Like, it wouldn't make sense. So no, I don't do it.
And yet, young writers today do not have the same advantages we had as younger writers. The athletes truly do not need us. It's only maybe after their careers when they want to, they're going to miss us when we're gone, in a sense. But that's probably why you've had so much success in a sense, too, that you've gotten so many ex-athletes to talk. Because they do miss it, right? They miss it. But now when they're still playing and you're trying to get what happened with, you know, David Wright's groin pull with the Mets, you know, as a Newsday writer. Yeah.
No, I think it's funny how many of these guys blow us off when they're playing and then ask if we'd write about them.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I've found that for sure. Jeff, it's a great book. Three Ring Circus. Huffton Mifflin is the publisher. I encourage all my young readers to read it. It's a lesson in reporting. And Jeff's got 8 other books that are New York Times bestsellers. So, Jeff, thanks so much for doing this. Get some rest and see your family again. And hopefully I'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it.
That was great.
Thank you so much. Right. Appreciate it, Jeff. Take care. All right.